Hello and welcome to Written in Uncertainty, an Elder Scrolls podcast sat firmly in the grey maybe of Tamriel. My name is Arimithias, and today I'm discussing one of the most universal questions in all mythology and applying it to Tamriel, trying to disentangle the chaos of the dawn and work out an answer to that fundamental question, where do men come from? Before we get to that though, I wanted to start by saying thank you to Wheels, who's been a fan of this show for several months now and has made a lot of noise about it on Twitter in particular, and they've just become my latest patron. If anyone else wants to become my patron, you get access to the notes I make for this cast ahead of time and early access to all of the content I produce, and you can get that by heading over to patreon.com/writteninuncertainty. With just one more patron, I can start having a fully self-hosted website, which is actually going to be optimized for my content rather than putting up with the rather limited themes and so on that I've been having for WordPress so far. Or on the other hand, if you just want to leave me a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/Arimithias. That's ko-fi.com/Arimithias and drop a tip in the jar. I've also had a correction recently from Enrico Dandolo to my Amaranth episode. I managed to entirely misread the last line of Sermon 37 as worldling of the worlds rather than the correct worlding of the worlds. That puts a whole new spin on things, because rather than being a child of the world, Enrico was kind enough to point me in the direction of Heidegger, who used worlding as a term to describe the process of making a life world, that is, a world as experienced by people. This is, for Heidegger, a natural reaction to the condition of being in the world. It's a constant construction of the world as something we experience, and it's a process that's ongoing and forever changing. And in this way, to me, it sounds rather like the process of understanding the Elder Scrolls lore and particularly creating headcanon. Everyone's perspectives are always going to be evolving through contact with new material. I think this potentially mirrors Michael Kirkbride's line of thought with the Amaranth, that is the process of making a new world, and while the Amaranth itself is not necessarily an ongoing process in the Elder Scrolls, like worlding is for Heidegger, it's certainly the end result of having a world that is as open and diverse in its lore as the Elder Scrolls. It's something that we cannot help but have a constantly evolving understanding of. I also wanted to say, given that constantly evolving understanding, that this particular podcast is my own understanding of where men come from and not the whole truth of things. We do have quite a partial view of this topic, at least from what I feel like we're intended to have. I would absolutely love to hear your own ideas on it. Please leave a comment wherever you're listening to this or at the blog post at writteninuncertainty.wordpress.com. I'll also be linking all of the sources that I quote in this cast in that blog post, so please check that out and come to your own conclusions on the matter rather than just taking what I say at face value. And you can also join the conversation at the Written in Uncertainty Discord server. And finally, if you've got anything that you want to ask me, please email me at writteninuncertaintypodcast@gmail.com. I would absolutely love to have a more expansive questions and answers part of this podcast, but I can only do that if you send me questions. And one final note before we kick off. When I say men here, I mean all members of the races descended from the Atmorans, Nees, Yokudans, and potentially parts of Akavir. I'm not meaning to imply anything about particular genders in the use of the term, but I'm also not going to use the term humans, as that often gets applied to all races in the Elder Scrolls, or at least all non-beast races. So where do men come from? As with most things in the Elder Scrolls, it depends on who you ask. According to what we know of most of their myths, men are created by the gods and tend to view Lorcan as a positive force because of that. This is in contrast to the Mer, who believe that they are descended from the gods. The monomyth describes this way of thinking as created beings as the humble path, in contrast to the rather more entitled view of the Mer. If you want to hear more about that difference, please listen to the episode of this podcast that I've done on the Man-Mer schism a while back. There is, however, one dissenting view from this narrative, which is, rather ironically, the one that most fans seem to take as the truest one. This particular dissension, which comes from the Anuad, has both Men and Mer deriving from the Elnafe, with Men coming from the wandering Elnafe who travelled throughout Mundus, and the Mer being the old Elnafe who just stayed in one place and tried to preserve what they were. The difference, according to this narrative, is initially one of ideology, not one of kind, although one does eventually become the other. The Anuad also calls the old Elnafe the Elnafe of Tamriel, with the wanderers scattering to the continents of Akavir, Atmora, and Yokuda. This is where the Anuad starts to tally up with the other myths that we have, although there are a few more questions there, which we'll get to a bit later. The thing I want to note for now is that this is happening after the war between the old and wandering Elnafe. Other myths, most notably the Heart of the World, the Alt-Murri creation myth, have this war happening when Men and Mer are already distinct and the continents are potentially already separate. I do want to take a little brief diversion here, however, and take a look at a few interesting quotes. We have this line from the Alt-Murri Heart of the World creation myth. Auriel could not save Alt-Mora, the Elder Wood, and it was lost to Men. They were chased south and east to old Elnafe, and Lochan was close behind. He shattered that land into many. Bear in mind here that Old Mora is literally Elder Wood in the language Alt-Meris. Then consider a few bits from the Varieties of Faith, which comes from the Imperial College. First, we have a description of Orki, a Nordic god of death. To quote that, Orki, Old Knocker, a lone god of the Nords who seems to have taken up his worship during Old Murri rule of Atmora. And then this about Hermamora. Hermamora, the woodland man, ancient Atmoran demon who at one time nearly seduced the Nords into becoming Aldmer. Taken together, I think these two quotes seem to imply that Men were not entirely men in their earliest days in Atmora. I've seen some say that this means that Atmora and Old Meris are the same place, but while I did once think that, I'm not totally sure anymore. If the old Elnafe mentioned in The Heart of the World is Old Meris, which would be linguistically consistent with its use elsewhere, then it's fairly geographically distant from Atmora. You have to go south and west for it. Unless we take Atmora to be a part of Old Meris that later broke away. That is an option. That would match the idea of the sundering of purpose that the Numantia Intercept identifies with the destruction of Old Meris, with the areas that were claimed by Men then becoming the other continents. However, we don't really have a firm answer on that either way. It could be either. Possibly based on events after the sundering of the continents, most Mannish myths will claim that Men came from Atmora. The first edition Pocket Guide to the Empire states that the first Men came from Atmora to Tamriel and that they were the Nords. This is generally thought to be rubbish by the developers. If you look at a few out-of-game posts that they've made over time, this is a very, very simplistic narrative and probably wrong. Kurt Kuhlman posted this comment some years ago, to quote, "The hoary old out-of-Atmora theory has been widely discredited. No reputable archaeologist would publicly support it these days, but the imperial geographers continue to beat the drum of the Nordic fatherland in the best tradition of the Septim Empire." And Michael Kirkbride also posted this, "And for the last time, Needs are not Atmorans. That's just shoddy scholarship from a bygone regime." So it's fairly clear that the developers intended for the idea that Men simply come from Atmora to Tamriel, starting with the Nords, to be rubbish. There is some support for the idea that Men came from Atmora, but they weren't all Atmorans in the same way that Iskramor and his proto-Nords were. However, there's not an awful lot of text that allows them to really come from somewhere else. There is some support for the idea that Men did come from Atmora, but they weren't all Atmorans, so to speak, in the same way that Iskramor and his proto-Nords were. The book Frontier, Conquest and Accommodation, A Social History of Cyrodiil, says this, "Iskramor was certainly not the first human settler in Tamriel. In fact, in fleeing civil war in Atmora, as the Song of Return states, Iskremor was following a long tradition of migration from Atmora. Tamriel had served as a safety valve for Atmora for centuries before Iskremor's arrival. Now, this is a view that the 3rd edition pocket guide seems to back up. On this reading, the Needs were simply Atmorans who were culturally distinct enough from those things that we most commonly call Atmorans. And it's just time that's made them different and the time they spent in Tamriel that means that they can be called something else. However, we do have some rather interesting implications from a passage in the Adabala which says this, to quote, Perif's original tribe is unknown, but she grew up in Sard and on Sardrava Lead, where the Aelids herded in men from across all the Nibben. Kothri, Need, Algemha, men of Creeth, although these were later known to be imported from the north. Keptu, men of Gi, who were eventually destroyed when the Flower King Nilichi made a great sacrifice to an insect god named Lost. Alharad, men of Ket, others, but this was Syrod, the heart of the Imperatum Sileche, where men knew no freedom, even to keep family, or choice of name except in secret, and so to their alien masters all of these designations were irrelevant. This gives Needs as one group among many who were present in Cyrodiil in the First Era. This runs in contrast to the claim of Frontier and Conquest, which says that Needs were the name for lots of groups that came from Atmora on many stages. We do have this quote from Abner Tharn, however, which may reconcile things. The term Needic tribes actually covers a wide panoply of different human cultures from different parts of Atmora with a variety of traditions and practices. For the Needs, Tamriel became a great mixing cauldron. Some Atmoran practices were retained, but many were lost. In Nibbene alone do we find the kind of continuity that sheds light on original Needic culture, for only here were the great old traditions maintained in any fidelity. Going on this reading then, Needs could be both the tribe that first settled in Nibbene and a catch-all term for all of the Cyrodiilic Mannish tribes that were present in the First Era. This is the same kind of thinking that this is similar to how the name China in our world is thought to have derived from the Qin or Qin, I'm not totally sure how you pronounce it, which was the name of the first imperial dynasty in China, which was only one of several warring states for the first period of its existence. However, I should note that this still does equate all Needic tribes with Atmora in some way, rather than saying that some of the tribes were already on Tamriel. I think it does, however, give us a possible framework to explain why the Needs are only one of several groups mentioned in the Adabala. So, given all that, I'm inclined to think that, like Need, Atmoran could have multiple meanings, and only Iskremor's actual wave is given the title of Atmorans in the sense it's most commonly used. And now I'm going to turn to a text that makes me think that the Nords throw all of that out the window. It's called Children of the Sky, and it gave me, frankly, some really inflated expectations of what to expect the Nords to be capable of before Skyrim came out. The bit that we need to worry about for our current discussion is this, to quote, Nords consider themselves to be the children of the sky. They call Skyrim the throat of the world, because it's where the sky exhaled on the land and formed them. They see themselves as eternal outsiders and invaders, and even when they conquer and rule other people, they feel no kinship with them. If this is true, then the Nords were created on Tamriel, not scattered to Atmora as the Anuad states, and then they come back later. There's no way to reconcile this directly with our other sources, so we can either dismiss it entirely, which in my opinion would be boring, or we see what we can make of it. The Nords being made in Skyrim could possibly be a metaphorical term, I think. They weren't Nords until some point while they were in Skyrim. I think that we can possibly tie this to when they stopped looking at Atmora as home rather than in a literal creation process. King Wolfarth, who ruled Skyrim from around the 480th year or the first era to the 533rd, was called the Breath of Kine in his five songs, and he was also the king to renounce all holdings on Atmora. So rather than being breathed out by Kine in Skyrim, I think it's possible that the Nords were instead made into the people of Skyrim by the Breath of Kine, by the king who sundered them from their Atmoran holdings and their Atmoran origins. If being breathed out is more a figurative description of an historical event rather than a creation myth, that rather leaves the Nords hanging as to where they think they were actually created. We have a Cyrodiilic creation myth and a Yokuden creation myth, and the Bretons know that they were descended from Nedic tribes subjugated by the Dorini Elves in High Rock. But we don't have an explicit creation myth for the Nords. They have a creator and a destroyer deity in the shape of Alduin and Kine as their kind of patron for them as a people, but little account of how any of that actually happened or happens as a process. The way that Alduin is presented as a cyclic thing, he is the wellspring of the Nordic pantheon and then its destroyer, means that we seem to see the Nords as one culture that, if you believe the seven fights of the Aldudaga and Shore Son of Shore, explicitly acknowledges Kalpas as a thing that happens in the Elder Scrolls cosmology. And we would then expect something that's cyclical and extra Kalpic in their creation myth, like we have in the Yokuden and Argonian myths. For that, we have to turn to one of Michael Kirkbride's forum posts, which was called On the Nord's Lack of a Creation Myth, roughly. And in particular, we have this quote. "Let me show you then the proper way to ask the Nords their proper place in history. Ask them to tell you the oldest story that they know that's also the best. That will get you as close to a creation myth as anything else, even if the next telling changes it a bit, but that's beside the point of being the point. Just because we hate to waste time in Skyrim, we have lots of it to use with nothing else to do, and there's no better way to use up time without wasting it than by telling a good story. And the best of the oldest stories we still know is untranslatable, which I guess you'll probably want to hear after you get me another round." It's a little annoying that the oldest story that the speaker knows is left untranslatable, because we then don't get anything to directly link it with, but I think that if we go with the oldest Nordic story, that's probably the tale of Ísgrimór and the 500 Companions. And Ísgrimór functions as the harbinger of us all, the first Nord, so to speak. And we just so happen to have that tale. The 500 Mighty Companions, or thereabouts, of Ísgrimór the Returned was posted by MK on the Bethesda forums in February of 2011. Most germane for this discussion is the first and last paragraphs, and I give no apology for my horrible mangling of the names. It will take far too long for me to record this properly if I get the pronunciation right every time. The story begins like this. "The first of Ísgrimór's 500 mighty companions was actually two, the ashen amalgamation of his sons that had survived Sarthal only to die in the freeze rains of the returning, named Sunaltir and Stunalmir while alive and now called the Grit Prince and Sunal, whose tier wives were Vrimali, Jilar Yarlial, Alir, and Tusk Widow, who forswore her name, whose wine wives were Elia Hate Basket and Ingridal, who lost her casket at the burning, and Mireli Al Half Casket, whose half wives were none survived, and whose kind wives were none survived, and whose shield wives were Shan Yenen the Echo Eaten, and Hyan's daughter, whose name stays in its cradle." And the first part of the final paragraph of the story is this, and these names are going to be even more mangled, I'm sorry. "With the Morag broken and sent into the eastern slush, we finally caught sight of Snowthroat and knew that our journey was near its ending again. It was the World Eater's waking that broke shore first, shouting our victory and doom, whose boat thane was Yzmalifax, the northern dragon, his first clutch sons, Tsunalinfaxtir and Stunuhalisfanal, whose tear jills were Voramalix, Yarlialis, Aliersugus, and the Dewclaw widow who forswore her name, whose voyages were El Yarlithalisthalif, hate fire with Ingrid Aliglu, who lost her minutes in the mending, and Miarilar Lunax, whose magna gills were Shanu Uyenin, the Star Woven, and Yarl Hringithax, whose name stays in its egg. Once you adjust for Ysmarlithax not having a named equivalent in the ending, the names of the first companions and the first dragons mirror each other pretty much exactly. I've mangled the pronunciations, the spellings are just little distortions here and there, and different formulations of the same core principles. If you look at the things that aren't the names, you get a better picture. And given that, I think it's clear that Ysmarlithax represents Ysgrimor himself. And given that particular lead, Tosok put together a fantastic theory on the old Bethesda forums that basically suggests that the Nords of the previous Kalpa were the ones that tore down Lig, thanks to a bunch of references in that text to the adjacent place, and that they also have some relationship with dragons. While Tosok suggests that this is possibly the Dragon War, reflecting the War of the Drow on Lig, I'd suggest that it's possibly something simpler than that. Tosok does suggest that the Nords are Alduin at some point, in that they destroy the world. I read that as the possibility that the Nords become the dragons of the next Kalpa. Many revolutions do ultimately turn on those who initiate them, after all. We also have the line from Varieties of Faith that, to quote, "The Nords could not look on Talos or Ysmir without seeing a dragon." There is some special circumstance here. I mean, Talos was a dragonborn after all, but the way that the others are talked about in the 500 Companions text makes me think that it's possible that others can transform that way too. Possibly something to do with Draco Chrysalis, which, as I understand it, literally means changing into a dragon, but we know fairly little about that process for certain, and I don't want to open that can of worms without making it a bigger focus of the cast as a whole, which leaves us with the Yokudans and something else at the end for those of you that have been paying attention. I covered the origin of the Yokudans in some ways in the episode on Kalpas, but we can go over them again here for completeness. These men came from another landmass, which is either just another part of Nirn, or possibly from a previous cycle of the world. They also allegedly destroyed it, apparently in order to reach Tamriel, if you believe Mysterious Akavir. Just a hint, I don't really. I honestly don't think we should, and there are other accounts that attribute its sinking to natural disaster, to the use of forbidden sword techniques, and various other things. We don't really know enough for a firm answer as to precisely what sunk it, although the current consensus does seem to be that it's a sword stroke sinking the continent, a particular technique that was used by the Ansei. The Red Guards themselves are quite Moorish in their outlook, in that they see themselves as spirits wrongfully sundered from their heavens. Their origins are plainly those of spirits breeding in order to stay alive in their creation myths. They're also far more active in trying to get back to being gods again, and that's a similar perspective to the Altmer, but there doesn't really seem to be that drive to strive to make yourself a god again in most Moorish culture. I'm not sure that we can therefore say that the Red Guards would want to necessarily reach Tamriel for any particular reason, as if they have the answers for how to get back in their original culture, they'd have to try all the harder to hang on to it, and that it would potentially risk missing out on getting back to the Far Shores. So I think the exodus from Yokuda is more down to an ideological split that the Regarda, the warrior wave of Yokudans who came to Tamriel, had with the other side of Yokudan society. It also strikes me as a little similar to how Ysgrimor first came to Tamriel. He was allegedly fleeing civil war in Atmora, although he wasn't split on an ideological level with the rest of Atmora, it must be said. he was entirely happy, for one thing, with the existing dragon cult. I have heard it suggested that the Yokuden Civil War was actually the same thing as the fight with the left-handed elves who were previously exterminated on the continent, that the distinction between the followers of Hera and Hunding's sword singers was enough to change their ideology and therefore change their skin. Remember how the wandering and old Elnafei split. I think that's a really cool idea, but I don't think it's really backed up with the text that we have. There aren't any events that really overlap between those two events, so we can't say that one definitely maps onto the other. I have a feeling I may have stated this as a possibility somewhere before, and if so, I apologise. I don't think it's the case anymore, but I'm allowed to change my mind. The Red Guards are also quite distinct in that they are possibly a younger culture than the other Mannish cultures. We have accounts of Atmoran's needs and so on from the Merithic era, which stretches back 2,500 years before the First Era. We don't have any dating of the Red Guards until what would have been around 850 years or so after that. I suppose you can possibly argue that this is probably due to a lack of history as such, because Iskremor doesn't come to Tamriel until around the 1,000-year point in the Merithic era, and didn't start recording history until quite a bit after that. So this could be a similar thing for the Yokudans. That they're that much further forward in their development does, however, mean that all of their activities since they've come to Tamriel have been very well documented, even if we are left with a few questions about their origins on Yokuda itself. We do know a lot more about their culture on Yokuda than we do about the Nord's culture on Atmora, for example, but they do seem to have always been there. Unless we take the Anuad's account that they are also descended from the wandering Elnafei, we have very little to go on that contradicts that. Their own creation myth is different enough that it's also entirely possible that they could have come from another cycle of the world altogether. Again, if you want to hear my take on that, check out my episode on Kalpas. The last race of men that are mentioned in the Anuad are the Tsaisi of Akavir. These are possibly not men, if you listen to most of the tales that circulate about them, but vampire snakes who ate the men of Akavir. Mysterious Akavir puts it like this: "The serpent folk ate all of the men of Akavir a long time ago, but still kind of look like them." As I said in my cast on Trinimac 2 weeks ago, eating something is understanding something or assimilating them, rather than literally eating as such. Or at least that's a possible answer. The Tsaisi may have potentially become men for a time and then diverged, we don't really know. However, they are certainly close enough in relation that they can breed with men. The first edition Pocket Guide to the Empire says this: "Akaviri surnames are rare and prized possessions among the Cyrodiilic citizenry of today, and there are trace facial features of the Akaviri in many distinguished Cyrodiilic families." The trace facial features suggest some level of compatibility with the Akaviri and the Cyrodiils, enough to breed, at least, although I would note that this is Akaviri, not necessarily Tsaisi. There is the assumption that they are Tsaisi from the accounts of the invasion, which describe it as a Tsaisi invasion in how the Akaviri first came over and got involved with Cyrodiil. Whether there were also men from an unknown stock mixed in with the snake people that were functioning as auxiliaries or something, we don't really know. However, I would point back to the idea that the Tsaisi can look like men, and so they could possibly be the Tsaisi themselves. The former Loremaster Lawrence Schick did, however, say that the Tsaisi are possibly shapeshifters as well, introducing more possibilities for what the Tsaisi are. One of those explanations that the Saisi look like men or are men seems to me the easiest explanation. The most prominent account of them looking like snakes is the 2920 series, which is in-universe fiction, although they are called snakes in several other places as well. And on that note, I think that's about all we can talk about for the origins of men without delving into a whole bunch of rabbit holes about each particular one. I may have to get around to doing entire casts on the early histories of each of those, just so we can go into that a little bit more depth. I do hope you've enjoyed this look through of all of the Mannish cultures, and I hope it gives you a deeper appreciation of where all of the various cultures that we're probably most likely to identify with come from in the Elder Scrolls. If you like what you've heard here, please do consider subscribing and leaving a review wherever you listen. If you would like to support me in a more personal way, drop me a tip at ko-fi.com/Aramithius or become my patron at patreon.com/writtenincertainty. Patrons get early access to all of the content I put out and an exclusive look at the notes that I make to prepare for these podcasts. Links to both of those will be in the cast description, as well as available on the Written in Uncertainty website, where you can see the full blog post that goes alongside this cast and find all the texts that I'm pulling this information from. If you have any comments on this episode or the podcast in general, please drop me a line at writtenanuncertaintypodcast@gmail.com. I would absolutely love to hear your feedback, and I'll be sure to respond to some of them on air in the next episode. Next week, we'll be continuing our in-depth look at the monomyth, looking at the Sijit creation myth in particular. After that, which may be the week after or may not, I will be probably in the process of getting ready to move house at that point, so there may be some delay. But after that, we'll be asking our next question, which is going to be about one of the most contentious and confusing events in Elder Scrolls history, and one I've said multiple times that I'll be doing a cast on. Then I will be asking what really happened at the Battle of Red Mountain. Until then, this podcast remains a letter written in uncertainty. You've been listening to Written in Uncertainty, a podcast written and presented by Aramithius. The music for this podcast has been kindly provided by Jan Glembotsky and Jeremy Saul. You can find Jan's work on SoundCloud under Songs from the Lost Land, and Jeremy's Northerner Diaries is available for purchase and on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.